Paper.
Welcome to episode 96 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand paper making and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand paper making studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I run a membership program called The Paper Year and teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. Today, I'm talking with Sarah Garden Armstrong, a visual artist whose decades-long practice embraces a wide range of scales and techniques, from large site-specific sculpture to artist books. Lyrical, nature-based, biomorphic abstraction characterizes the work, focusing on life processes and systems. It addresses organic change and transformation while exploring properties of materials. Armstrong received her Master of Fine Arts from the University of Alabama and a Master of Art Education from the University of Alabama, Birmingham. After living in New York City for 36 years, in 2017, she returned to Birmingham, where she currently lives and works. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Sarah Garden Armstrong, welcome to Paper Talk.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah. We met a long time ago in New York City when I was working at Dudonnet Paper Mill, and probably in the mid-90s. And you were doing a project there, and I'm looking forward to talking about your long artistic career. So tell me a little bit about where you grew up and how you got interested in art.
So I'm from Birmingham, Alabama, and I'm actually back here after being in New York for, you know, over 35 years, which actually is good. I didn't start into art. I really went through college the first time in elementary education. And then it wasn't until sort of problems and everything else that I realized I started doing art at the museum. And very quickly then went on to the university here and did equivalent to undergraduate in art, then to Tuscaloosa Graduate School, and shortly after that, taught here and then moved to New York. So it was sort of a fast one that I've never left since I started.
Right. And what kind of art were you introduced to? Because you were an interdisciplinary artist early on. Uh-huh. And So I'm curious about your college, or how that, you know, how you got interested in all of these interdisciplinary materials and technology.
To begin with, you know, I was older. So that sort of, in a sort of way, helps you to do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. And I sort of had this organic and very minimal angular contradiction duality from the very beginning. And so I worked in a number of directions. Then when I went to graduate school, I ended up in painting.
Okay.
And by the time I finished, one of the comments at the Orals was, "You are not a painter or a sculptor, and you're not going to find a job." But again, you know, a lot of things happen to us because we're at the right place at the right moment. So I just happened to be back at the University of Alabama in Birmingham and did get a job in the middle of the semester and taught here for a couple of years before moving to New York.
Okay. And what did you teach? And then how did you end up moving to New York?
I taught, since I had done elementary education, when I was doing undergraduate, I also did a master's in education and then went on to Tuscaloosa and finished. So I had that sort of between education and art. And so my mm-hmm. position was that it was that. With coming back, I got studio and managed to be kicked out of a couple of places and decided if I was living in Birmingham, Alabama, I was going to have a good studio. And so I ended up buying a building with someone. And that's where I am back still. It was it's been a great thing. It's an art building. It's completely an art building now, which is, it has been through the years, lots of different things, but mainly it's always had studios in it. And when with the building had a lot of work to be done on it. Mm-hmm. And so in the process of it, I ended up with having a wall fall on me. And so that was sort of a severe thing. I was teaching at the university then. And it was a sort of a positive experience because I ended up in the hospital with a subdural hematoma. And it was just like, oh, maybe you need to do whatever you want to do. And so it sort of gave me a little bit of those guts to move by yourself to New York. Mm-hmm. But I still did it in stages. The head of the department, it said to me, you can go up there for 3 months and then teach in the summer. And that's what I did. I went through 3 months and I realized it was fine. You don't need a job. You know, you can move to New York. Uh-huh. And I had friends there by then. So it was, and I knew to quit the job while I was in New York, because I might become a little bit nervous when I got back here.
Right. So mm-hmm. you did that for a number of years going back and forth.
I did the 3 months. I came back and taught mm-hmm. in the summer. And then I did have students that came up for sort of an interim semester, for a number of years up there. But it was a move to New York then.
Right. Okay.
And I've always been tied to Birmingham with the building. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, I didn't have a studio in this building until like 2014.
Right. So you rented out the building.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, cool. And so how did you end up finding paper and establishing yourself in New York as an artist? Yeah.
Well, so I did installations here and it was easier to have your own space. Mm-hmm. One of the shows I did at the museum was a sound piece. And I did a lot of drawings on handmade paper. And it was just, I was using that for dealing with how sound was moving through the space. I was very interested in all of that sort of part. And I did early sewing on the paper, but I didn't really get into the handmade paper until I got to New York. Mm-hmm. And the first show let me just back up a little bit. The first piece of sound, I was asked to be in a group sound show at PS1. And with that, I had always had spaces by myself. So I didn't want to compete with sound. So I decided that I would take one of the drawings, which dealt with this sort of dot pattern curve where I was talking about sound moving through the space. And with that, I was also at the same time renovating a sort of kitchen law space, you know, condensed sort of space. So I was dealing with sheetrock. Mm-hmm. And so with the PS1 show, I ended up building a corner space. And then I had pipes coming out, copper tubing, and air came out of each one after another. So that was, for me, that was sound. Air was moving. Right. It was a very low sound. You'd have to really listen for it to get it. But with that, I had to figure out how to get that air moving one hole after another. And so I ended up finally figured out how to build this box. Mm-hmm. And it had a disc and a blower in it, and it opened, it rotated, and it opened one hole after another. And they actually had two, so that the air blew on you. And what was really interesting for me about that was that it had the hoses breathed. This was all behind the wall, so you didn't see any of that.
Right.
And so I'm moving to New York after this, and I end up getting to have a show at Candessa Lawler Gallery. Mm-hmm. And what I did with that installation was I had the front of the wall with the pipes coming out, but then I had a curved wall and I had in the back of it were the blowers. And I had a show that was Sashka Ross, who at the same time, she was, you know, it was a two-person show. And she was so connected with paper and Dudenay. So that was sort of my introduction to Dudenay. I ended up doing more shape papers before I ended up with the Air Player, working with them.
Okay. So this is Dudenay Paper Mill in New York City, which has moved around over the years, but you were probably in the very first
Crosby Street to begin with.
Right. And let me ask you before we move forward, where your interest in sound came from?
The sound. Okay. Having a show at the university here, and I ended up, I was doing paintings that were shaped canvases mm-hmm. and airbrushed. And when I took that show down and put it, it was, you know, getting ready to wrap it up. I thought this is a lot more interesting than the show itself.
And wrapped up pieces.
Well, not even wrapped up, but sitting on the floor in different spaces. So I thought I really want to do a installation where you are walking around forms and the forms are changing of color. And a little bit after that, when I'm deciding I'm doing that, there was an art history person at the university. And he said, why don't you add sound? And I'll do the sound. Well, I worked on this piece for a year. It's 16 forms and, you know, built the frames and the canvas and stitched it. And so the speakers were in that. So there is no way that I would have liked anyone else's sound imposed on the forms. And so I, of course, didn't. But what it did, it made me say that I could do it. And so that is what happened, is that I ended up, it wasn't because I thought about it as much, but I knew that I could structure the sound in relation to the form changing of the negative and the positive spaces in relation to the color changes. And so then I very quickly after that did a piece and that I ended up doing the sound, where I went and recorded it, did very sort of guttural glass and inside of a piano with people, and then used the structures of the forms and the color changes to develop the score for it.
Wow. I hear what you're saying. I had someone make sound for a film piece I made once, and the first iteration he sent me, I didn't know what I wanted at all. And so I just sent him the video, and then he did the sound, and it was wrong. I knew immediately when I listened to it. And then thankfully he was able with some feedback to go back and do it, but I can totally relate to that. And then taking control of it yourself. Yeah.
I think I didn't want him to change. I just wanted to figure it out.
Right.
Because I didn't really understand what I wanted and it was going to take me a while.
Right.
And so, but that really was my first sound. And it was because of a force in a sort of way.
Right.
And then when I was in New York, I started with the blowers with the Air Player series, which we hadn't talked about, but there is a blower and it's an off and on switching.
Right.
And so that became an instrument.
Right. And so what are the materials you use for that? Because that you've done many iterations throughout your career. And why did you do that piece in the first place?
Well, it came from the PS1 piece into the next. And then because I'm working with Dudenay with making shape paper. Mm-hmm. And then I thought I can put these hoses into paper.
Right.
And I also was very much, you know, very interested in cast shadows and also painted shadows. Because it's about that shift of realities. Mm-hmm. From the South, I had this sort of Gothic layeredness with a lot of the work and about what's real, what's not real. Mm-hmm. And I've been playing with that for a long time. Mm-hmm. And so those shadows and cast shadows really were part of the work early on.
Right, right. And we'll link to all of this. Sarah has a wonderful monograph, which we'll talk about later, but with lots of images and documentation of her entire career. And Air Player, again, is one that moves throughout. So, yeah. So how were you working with paper for these pieces?
For Air Player. Okay. So I am, it was first, I did an A, we made, you know, the cast and put the hoses in it with paper, with a cotton papers. Then there was a linen paper we worked with, and I'm going to there, you know, working there.
Right.
And then I decided I wanted to have more three-dimensional forms.
Mm-hmm.
And working with Paul Wong, who was just the best, he said, you're going to have to spray.
Okay.
And so that's when I started. I had to spray in my studio. Uh-huh. And I set that up.
And okay. So this is spraying pulp through... Mm-hmm. What do you call the mechanism?
It's a, it's like what you spray a ceiling with the right. ceiling with.
Right. So you're mm-hmm. shooting pulp onto mm-hmm. forms mm-hmm. and they didn't mm-hmm. do that at Dudonay, right?
No,
so
they really didn't have the space.
Yeah. Right. Right.
And so that was the major thing. It was mm-hmm. just, it was a space thing. And also what was heaven is I was able to get it under my control so that mm-hmm. I could experiment more.
Right. Right. And did you purchase pulp from them?
Yes. Or,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. And then you would haul it in New York City somehow to your studio.
Somehow. I wasn't very far from them at that okay. point. I was on Great Jones Street.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But it what continued with that series is that, you know, I continued with the shadows. I then ended up working with someone that, a tech person, Nick Dukoski, and he ended up with the computer being able for us to turn, you know, the switching mechanism helped make those pieces more composed. Mm-hmm. And then we added a layer of sound after that.
Right, right. And so how did you, I guess, what's the force been behind the different iterations? I know you're exploring further and further, uh-huh. but did you line up new exhibition opportunities or just continue making the work and then exhibition opportunities came? I'm just curious about that kind of cycle.
So with that series, it really, I needed to have a space to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
So those exhibitions were pretty much lined up. I did turn my space, which was a ground floor on Great Jones Street, mm-hmm. into a gallery. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up getting a show after that at another gallery. And that sort of led to some more things. But it also, you know, this was doing these installations. There really was no money. You spent a lot of money. And right. So that was part. And then eventually I decided I wanted to do a book that sort of condensed 10 years of installations.
Right.
Which could then be carried and taken somewhere. And that's when I did the Air Player book and little book.
Right, right. Yeah. And how many of those did you produce?
The small book, the little one that you opened up with the lenses and the light in it, probably 700.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I sold one, I lost money. Because they were very labor intense. The larger one, I did the parts for something like 65, but I did not do more than probably about 15. I have parts to do a few more
right.
that I might try at some point. It was came out in 1990.
Right.
And so it was pretty high tech at that point because it had the EEPROM ran the sound and light changes in this little miniature environment.
Right.
Figuring it out was one of the hardest projects.
Right.
I think I always think of everything as hard until it gets done.
Oh, yeah. I agree with that. Yeah. And then when it's done, you're like, oh, okay, now I have another tool under my belt that I could use for something else. Or maybe I never want to do that again. Uh-huh. Yeah. Wow. And I know you've done several commission pieces using paper. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that a little bit. How did those come about? And maybe we'll talk about your piece, Sentient Matrix.
Yeah. Those were, okay, that commission, the sentient piece, was done. It actually was here in the university, and the Multiple Sclerosis Society raises money by honoring a business person, and that business person gets to select a piece of art. Okay. And, I had just recently sent something to that person about another installation, which was a breathing piece. Uh-huh. And he with an atrium, and I think he thought I could do something, but this time it had to be about multiple sclerosis. And I, number one, did not know much about the disease. Number two, realized that eventually it had to be light and not breathing. It would be light moving. And so I spent a very, very long time trying to understand the disease before I even could move forward with it.
Right.
And then the light was just another giant. It ended up, I used LED moving and had a programmer that worked with me with that. But just to get to that point was, for me, was really hard. But it opened up a whole nother world where I can use light in my sculpture now.
Right. And we'll post a link to, you have videos uh-huh. and images of this work because yeah, the light moves through mm-hmm. the forms so and yeah.
Yeah. It's really an abstraction of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And then it is this large form and it's hanging and sort of a neck where all the electronics go back in, which for me feels like tree landscape. Mm-hmm. And the LED lighting is moving through abaca forms. And it is then when it changes and turns red, it's referencing that there's some problem and it sort of stops. Mm-hmm. And then that's a problem that the brain is not able to connect with an arm or leg or something.
Right. And this is a permanent piece?
Yes. This is a permanent piece.
Uh-huh, yeah. Uh-huh. And have you gotten feedback from visitors or people who have multiple sclerosis uh-huh. or family members? Just curious.
I have
yeah.
gotten.
Yeah.
And it what's really interesting to me is that the piece, it sort of explains abstractly how MS works. And one of the things that I had been when I'm building this piece, I was so concerned this is an art piece. And I sort of did not think about that communication that the piece would have.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't an illustration. It was
an environment.
An environment. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes we can become a little narrow in what we think.
Mm-hmm. Well, and yeah, you get feedback from the viewers. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here. And I want to let you know that my new book, The Art of Papercraft, is now out in the world. The book offers a rich variety of projects that will delight crafters, artists, and designers alike, including paper votive lights, pop-up cards, folded paper gift boxes and envelopes, woven paper wall hangings, miniature one-sheet books, and much more. If you'd like an autographed copy, you can order that directly from me at HelenHebertStudio.com. And if the autograph doesn't matter to you, the book is available wherever fine books are sold. It's also available on Kindle. And by the way, my book, Papermaking with Garden Plants and Common Weeds, has also just been released on Kindle. And my other papermaking book, The Papermaker's Companion, has been available on Kindle for a couple of years. Now back to our conversation.
Now, I want to hear a little bit about your process. And I know you're working now on, you have been some museum shows, and you build like the whole museum, quite large models to figure out how to exhibit. And then I know drawing is also an important part of your practice.
Why don't I sort of start back? Maybe I should talk a little bit about the monograph first.
Okay.
That ended up.
Yeah.
And because the shows have sort of grown out of that.
Okay.
When I came back to Birmingham,
which was when?
It was in the end of 2017.
You moved back permanently.
Moved back to Birmingham. And so I had done this, worked with the Joan Mitchell Call Foundation, and they had with archiving work. And so I'm showing that all of this sort of with someone, a curator, and he was saying that, you know, there was a lot of work that he didn't know about. And so he said, let's do a traveling show of old and new work together and site specific. And then what happened with that is he talked to the University Press and decided that there could be a sort of catalog coming out of this.
Okay, tell me a little bit about the Joan Mitchell Call.
Oh.
What is that, like the archives? They do projects with artists?
Yes, they did. They're not doing that now.
Okay.
But they felt like that artists really needed, and I think they still feel very strongly about this, that artists need to archive their work.
Right.
And that's what the Call Project is. And I got this through Space 111, which is in Birmingham, and ended up, it was just at a moment for me, which was amazing because I had just brought a huge amount of work from upstate New York to be stored in the building. And was also at that moment in time thinking, who on earth are you? Here, you've got all this artwork you've left here. Now you've got all of this other artwork coming back down here. And it was a way to slowly sort of look at my work,
right?
The old and the new. And then out of that eventually grew this monograph.
Mm-hmm.
But, and so with the Joan Mitchell Foundation, they could not keep with the computer and their program. It was just too much for them to continue with updating it and getting all the kinks out. You know, they're not tech people. This is not the business they're in.
Right.
But I think they very much feel strongly that as artists, we need to know what our work is about.
Right.
And have a record of it.
Mm-hmm. So important. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So continue then about the monograph. And I think you worked on that through COVID quite a bit.
Yes, I did. It started with a university press.
Mm-hmm.
But the deadlines, and so writers had been asked and all this, the deadline was very soon because the shows Paul Barrett I was working with ended up having shows scheduled in about 17, 18 months.
Mm.
And they wanted all the material, images, writing, way fast. And it was just like impossible to have done. There's no way. I did not know how impossible it was at that moment, but it was way impossible. And since the project had already begun, I decided that I would just do it.
Okay.
And which... again, was, very lucky. What it did, I think, was to make me get to look and spend a huge amount of time of looking backwards and looking at the influences. The book began with mainly having sculpture in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that the largest body of work that I have is flat, includes painting, paper, and I thought, why isn't that included? What's wrong here? But I had time to figure it. So I made this giant chart with, all of this arrows going back and forth with work and with images, trying to figure out how everything was relating.
Right.
And then realized that flat work had to go in the monograph, and then tried to organize it and think about the relationship, how it related to sculpture, how it grew out of sculpture, right, and how it was on its own, but the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I've always worked on paper, and drawing has been a very big part of how I work as an artist.
Do you have special certain papers you like that you just stock all the time for drawing? Or is it not really that special?
I've had different papers at different times.
Uh-huh.
The one fiber I've stayed with for years is abaca. Because it has a translucency, mm-hmm, or it has a skinness, or it has a texture.
Right.
And I'm doing it even with paintings right now, and I call them paintings, even though they're done with abaca fiber and pigment for paper. So it's not, and the pigment that you color paper with is so much stronger.
Right.
And so I'm staining it a lot. I'm having a residue from the fibers on the, I'm using raw canvas. And then I'm having, I'm peeling and adding paper fiber again that's been dried.
Right. And are you still working with paper in your studio now?
Yes.
And how do you beat your pulp?
Right now, I do have a beater, but it's, okay, it's one that's not, it's not the best beater. But right now I'm using, from a friend at UAB, I'm not getting a lot of pulp,
right,
but I'm just getting it from there.
Right.
Again,
right,
it's abaca.
Right. And you're spraying it when you use it?
No.
I'm
pouring.
What are you doing? You're pouring.
And peeling.
Okay.
And yeah, I don't have the setup for spraying right now.
Right.
But I have sprayed abaca on paper and used it as texture. And a lot of methylcellulose keeping that paper flat to dry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But
cool. How are you drying it?
The canvases that I'm working on right now are, I'm just putting them in a box,
mm-hmm,
a cardboard box with plastic. And then sometimes I'm taking some of the fiber off that's being peeled, or putting that on paper, on plastic, in the different surfaces or the different way it will, the edges will react.
Right.
Right. So it's, again, it's a lot of change and reacting to chance things that are happening.
Right. I want to read this quote that you sent me, because I think it fits well right here. And it's really about your process. We artists spend our lives struggling with the creative process. Within each piece of art, there are problems to be solved. My own work may involve extensive research, exploration, and/or experimentation. Chance and change are important factors, as are accidental discoveries. Unexpected doors open. You have to walk through in order to move forward. You don't know where it might lead, but you know that it will lead to something. I love that. I love that. Does an example come to mind?
I also just believe that, problems, even though we don't really like them and they don't feel good, are real gifts.
Yeah.
Because it pushes you. It sort of kicks you in the britches to do a little bit more.
Right.
Because you have to solve it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So tell me about your building today. What's in the building and what are you working on? You showed me just before we got on here, uh-huh, this big model for your upcoming show.
Yeah. So I'm working on, this will be the last of the traveling show. It has had the same title as the monograph, Sarah Garden Armstrong Threads and Layers. And with each of the locations, it's been site specific for that location, because they've been from locations that are like 1200 square feet to one that was 8,000 square feet.
Wow.
And again, I'll just stop there and say a little bit, but when I did the 8,000 square foot this last year, I ended up realizing I had to pull back with a good bit older work, and I brought back the early canvas piece that I had done in 79. Mm. And with that, the sound is moving around. So it's sort of like a conversation within that piece. I will use that in this Gadsden show because, again, the space is big enough. And then the other thing which I started back was the Air Player series. And with that, I ended up using projection on it in Fort Lauderdale. Mm-hmm. And because of the drama, it's a warehouse. It was not white walls. So there was no casting and airbrushing shadows on those. So it had to be much more the drama of projecting.
Right.
And but the next, what I'm doing now with that, which is more, is going into more of a white walls, is I have interior lighting in a number of the forms now. And I will also be doing another projection, which I realized later came very much out of an early print series that I did. I think sometimes with our work, we don't realize that we pick something from way back there that has been done, that you sort of date and bring it up. I'm always surprised that there's a familiarity with something and I don't know where it came from. Until later, mm-hmm. you think, oh, yes, I've done that. I've done something just like that.
Right.
And so those will be in the Gadsden show. And I did, with most of this traveling show, I built a model. I have to sort of understand, it's not critical, but it helps me to understand the space.
Right.
It helps me to put, you know, the little forms in. Mm-hmm. Think about what are the angles you're going to look at to get an order to your brain with thinking about that. When you get in the actual space, you know you're going to make some changes, but you have a sort of background of thought and
right.
to help you feed into those changes, because installing, you don't have months to install. So, you know, it's a limited time and you need to be really working.
Right. And these are like site specific, obviously.
Yes.
It's always your work, but you're changing sites. So all these things, the lighting and the sound mm-hmm. is different in each space. Do you visit the spaces always, like before?
Yes, I
even do the model?
I didn't get to do that with the Fort Lauderdale space.
Okay.
Because it was too far for me to get
right.
down to.
Right.
But I did definitely build a very good model. Mm-hmm. I got photographs. I got photographs of the ceiling. How was I going to do the hanging
right.
parts? Where was the light coming in? Where was the air coming in? You know, they had garage doors that opened. How was that going to affect the forms?
Right.
So I do a lot of study.
Yeah.
To get as much information as I can to understand it. Now, Gadsden is an hour from here, so I've definitely been there a number of times. I have actually photographs of the space here that I printed up so that I can sort of keep looking back and forwards.
Right. Right.
And I was just going to say, with each location, it hasn't been the same work. Some pieces like the, environment, the early canvas piece, it had been shown two times.
Mm-hmm.
And with the one in Fat Village in Fort Lauderdale, and then with the Gadsden Museum. And so there are a lot of always change. And I always am doing some new work for every place too. I think that's been a really important part of this,
mm-hmm.
is that it has, you know, old in relation to the new. Just jumping back on a comment, I was talking about the book, but
yeah.
I always had this, because I go in so many directions, I've always worried about how does the work hold together? And doing the monograph and being able to look at that and think what this was about
mm-hmm.
and how that it became for me much more cohesive to understand. It just wasn't one piece sitting next to another. You had to have a few more connecting parts. And right now I have the early canvas piece right next to some of the current canvas paintings.
Right.
So that's been, it's interesting. I think we need all to sort of not look at, when we look at our work, we need to take a bigger picture of it.
Yeah, I heard another artist talk about circles.
Yes.
Or a spiral. It's like uh-huh. you're going around mm-hmm. and you're going uh-huh. back and you're going forward and
mm-hmm. and you're picking up something. It's yeah. not, I mean, we always want to think it's going up a hill.
Right.
And I think every once in a while we do something that sort of shoots up and that's good. But
yeah.
we are continuing going forward.
Right.
And back.
Right. Right.
And it makes it more I think that attitude takes some of the pressure off of, you know, that fact to think that you're getting better and better. No, you did some really good things way back there.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And you might do some really good things out there in the future.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I wanted to comment on what you were saying about visiting the spaces, because I did a recent lighting piece in a library and light. I had never been there at night until the ending event, because the library is not closed, you know, it's closed uh-huh. and it's summer. So it wasn't uh-huh. ever dark when I was there. And there was a beautiful view from outside in the backyard of the library, looking in, seeing uh-huh. my piece, which, you know, so there, it's fun to have those surprises. You think yeah. you think it all through, but then there are uh-huh. always some nice.
There's something else that you haven't. I mean, it is interesting because you only saw it in the daytime.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So what are the dates of the Gadsden show? Because this episode's coming out in about a month, so it might
okay.
be relevant.
The show will open November the 5th.
Okay.
I'll do an artist talk. So it's the sort of reception, and that will be November the 19th. And then it runs through January the 27th of
2023.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And tell me the name of the museum.
The Gadsden Museum of Art, which is in Gadsden, Alabama.
Okay, wonderful. Yeah, and let's just talk a little bit about, you've talked about working with other people. For technology, lighting, sound, figuring out some of it yourself, but also I think you have assistants in your studio mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have always worked with people.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's an energy. What you say to them, or what mm-hmm. you don't say, or what they say, sometimes can open your eyes to something.
Mm-hmm.
With all the atrium commissions I've worked with, you know, I definitely had an assistant or assistants, and it just depends on the project. I would have to say more than one. The other thing is that a lot of times I don't know how to get from A to B or A to C. And let's just take the example of the LED lighting. And I didn't know what kind of lighting I needed to move through these abaca forms in this atrium abstraction of the brain. And was somebody else going to be doing the lighting, you know? And I like to work with someone
mm-hmm.
because I sort of can understand how something can through their knowledge and what they give to me. And so I am not going to, I'll back up. At the very beginning of this, someone said to me, I was asking for advice, is, oh, you can do that. That's, and I thought, I really don't want to. I don't want to spend, you know, months studying how to do this. Someone else is much brighter in this than I am. And I can get some help, but it takes a while for you to figure out who and where mm-hmm. and what.
Right.
And so there are a lot, I did, you know, talk to as many people as I could about LEDs, ordered things, had test things here, and eventually found the person that was the programmer and also hardware person, mm-hmm. and with the LEDs. And mm-hmm. but that's just, and that's one of the things. It's a continual, whenever I just think that we can enlarge how we do things. The book, I had tons of people
right
that I worked with. This isn't just the editor, and I ended up doing the graphic design because I really wanted to play with the book like a space, like right. model with a space.
Yeah.
But I needed a lot of help to do that.
Yeah.
And a lot of a learning curve with it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it was a slow process. So that was, I think it was helpful that I wanted to. But again, because of that, I just had, and I guess it's just good to work with people for me.
Yeah, I love working with people myself, from just having an intern in the studio mm-hmm, to mm-hmm. bounce ideas off of. And I feel mm-hmm. like they can glean something from what I tell them, but they often mm-hmm. have feedback as well. And then you're reminding me of, I've worked with a choreographer for a dance piece for my Mother mm-hmm. Tree project. And I talked to several people before I found the one that, mm-hmm. yeah, we just seemed to have this rapport and she really understood. And I just could tell she was going to do something beautiful with it,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
it takes time, as you say, to,
yeah,
for all of those things to gel.
And it also be ready to make some mistakes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And then for me, it also takes a few minutes, sometime when I know, I feel a feeling's not so good about something. And then it takes me a while to digest and figure out what's going wrong here.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And part of that problem it comes from is that I don't have a complete clear thought about what I'm trying to do.
Right.
It's, it is a step-by-step one.
Yeah, it's a journey into the unknown with a strong foundation. Yeah,
right,
I totally understand that, Sarah. That's wonderful.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Well, let's end up talking a little bit just about juggling art and life.
Okay. So I have been doing that my entire life, I think.
Yeah, and what year were you born?
1943.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
So a few years. But right now, I'll just sort of tell you about where I am right now. And
okay.
Then maybe I'll go back.
All right.
I'm in this building mm-hmm. where it has studios and gallery and a ground floor contemporary or collective with shows once a month. And mm-hmm. and then the Alabama Architecture Center is also here. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of people and places. I am a landlord. I am a mentor. I am supposed to be a lot of different things. So I do juggle that. But this happens to be the best place I've ever been as far as being able to have a space to live and work and do. Mm-hmm. So in New York, I ended up with this business called Art Entree, where I did city tours and art tours.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have to research and, a lot of, I don't have a real good sense of direction. So I would also have to do a really good job of trying to figure out the routes and all of this. And I'm glad I loved it. And I'm so glad not to be doing it now.
Right.
But it's been, I came up with that business because I had early on done tours with, with students coming up to New York. But everybody in New York had an MFA. So, teaching job just didn't seem like an option.
Right.
And so that's how I ended up with having that job. Uh-huh. So I've done, I've just done different jobs and things go in different directions. And I just try to stay, I love to be focused and go in tunnel vision,
mm-hmm.
but we don't get to do that a lot. We get right. to have all those balls up in the air
Yeah.
And try to keep them going.
Yeah.
I do a lot of writing, trying to get myself, well, what do I have to do? And I do a daily schedule, then put it to another day and this sort of thing. I'm always working to try to make it clearer.
Uh-huh.
And but that seems to be part of it. And things do keep getting added to the schedule that you didn't realize that you still have to do.
Right. Right. And I want to make sure that we mention the monograph again, because that was a really concrete way of looking at your career and putting mm-hmm. it down on paper. And so it's called Sarah Garden Armstrong Threads and Layers, and it's available on your website and yes. through Amazon and several places. So I'll be sure to link in the show notes. Okay. And it's a wonderful book. I have a copy, and it's only $45. Do I have that right?
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
So if you're interested in reading more about Sarah's work, grab a copy. Yeah.
I'll just say one thing. You know, what was fun too with that is I did it visually, and I had the entire wall with the essays and the images so that I could keep looking at it because that's the way I work.
Right. Yeah, that's so important. The visual aspect. I remember when I was in my 20s, I moved to New York in my 20s too. And, you know, you live in small spaces there. And I was part of this art group for a while, and I would put everything away. And they said, no, you need to have it out so you see it all the time. So it jogs your mind. Yeah.
Because you can't, you know, you don't know when you're going to see something.
Right. Yeah.
You know, when you wake up or when you walk through, who knows?
Exactly. And how it relates to what happened that day or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A conversation you had. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's all wrapped up in your life. Mm-hmm. Well, Sarah, this has been a real treat talking to you. Thank you so much for sharing your life with paper and without with us.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can find out more at helenhebertstudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps others find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on podcast, where you can find out more about these guys, subscribe to this series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon.